So thanks very much for the invitation to speak today. It's a pleasure to tell you a bit about some of my research. So broadly, what I'm interested in is trying to understand the fundamental particle physics nature of dark matter. So we know that dark matter makes up most of the matter content of the universe, but we still have effectively no idea as to what it actually is. But I was just saying that broadly, I like to think about astrophysical systems, new ways we can use these to prove dark matter and dark matter signatures. I'm also interested in thinking about particularly these systems because of the really amazing multi-wavelength data that we have right now and we will have in the next few years. So I think this is particularly timely to think about what are the new ways we can use astrophysics to try and discover dark matter. So in terms of the talk today, I'm going to tell you about a few different signatures that I've worked on recently, as well as some of the inputs that are important to understand these signatures. So to do that, I'll start by telling you about how dark matter can be captured in different stars and planets and a range of different signatures that can arise when this happens. Also tell you about some recent work I did to derive new dark matter distributions inside different stars and planets. And this matters just because this can actually really drive how the signatures look. And I'll discuss implications for existing and future searches, including some new sensitivity using quantum devices on Earth, so just in the lab, as well as a new search for atmospheric ionization using planets like Jupiter. Okay, so the general picture is that we have a dark matter halo that extends much further out than the regular sort of visible content of our galaxy. And throughout this dark matter halo, we have lots of stars and planets peppered throughout. So they're all just moving around. And dark matter particles can come into contact with any of these celestial objects. And assuming there's an interaction between dark matter and the Standard Model, can scatter, lose some energy, and become gravitationally captured. And over time, more and more dark matter particles will build up inside these objects. And what happens next depends on the particle physics model. But one scenario is if dark matter annihilates, it can annihilate to Standard Model particles, which potentially can be absorbed by the star or the planet. So it'll be absorbed in the case that the annihilation is very prompt. So if you had annihilation to mediators that weren't very boosted, so this gamma is just a boost, or a pretty short lifetime, that leads to a decay length that's shorter than the radius of the object. On average, it just stays inside. And we can look for observables in that case, so things like neutrinos, which are fairly weakly interacting and can just stream out. We can think about things like the object might be heated up just from dark matter's mass energy being deposited inside the object. We can also think about a complementary class of signatures where if this decay length of the intermediate particle is either long-lived or very boosted, then the Standard Model particles can be produced outside the objects. So for example, one thing you can look for in this case, a gamma rays. So that's just a couple of quick examples. But really, there's quite a wide range of observables that are possible. So for annihilating dark matter, as the cases I just mentioned, heating or neutrino production in short-lived or not very boosted mediators, gamma rays or other final states for long-lived mediators, you can also have non-annihilating dark matter. And in that case, you can just have lots of dark matter building up inside the object to the point where you can create a black hole. That can then just destroy the object. And then usually we'll say, well, we know these objects exist, so we can rule out some dark matter parameter space from the fact that, a black hole wasn't created that destroyed the object. There are other signatures like changes in heat flow, just from the fact that you have another population sitting inside these objects. The heat transport can be a little bit different. You can also think about the fact that you can change how things like stars even evolve. And so if you put stars in a dark matter, very dark matter dense environment, for example, in the galactic center, there can be just so much dark matter inside them that you can even overpower nuclear fusion. And then the star will look totally different. So these are just some examples. But the point I want to make here and the point I want to emphasize is that these are highly detectable effects. So the effects of dark matter inside stars and planets aren't like some epsilon effect or something, maybe we see in 50 years' time. These are effects that in principle we should be able to see now, or at least we should be able to see within the next few years. And the important input that we want for any of these signatures, first of all, is the capture rate, so how much dark matter goes inside. But we also care about how dark matter is distributed inside the objects, because the distribution will drive the signals. So I'm now going to tell you how we actually calculate these. And shortly, I'll show you how this can affect some of the signatures. So in terms of the dark matter internal distribution, there's two regimes you can split the calculation into. So one are fairly strong interactions. And when I say strong interactions, I don't mean QCD sort of strong. I just mean strong enough that the bulk of the dark matter is captured. So if you want some ballpark number for a lot of objects, this is order 10 minus 35 centimeters squared. It can actually be a lot stronger or a lot weaker than this, depends on the object. But the strong interaction regime, I'm thinking mostly about something that has a fairly short mean-free path compared to the size of the object. And in this case, when dark matter particles go inside the star or the planet, the dark matter will really just thermalize pretty much immediately, or at least very quickly. And this regime we call local thermal equilibrium, in the sense that whatever kind of temperature you have locally, the dark matter roughly picks up. There's another regime where you have kind of weaker interactions. And in that case, you might have a mean free path, for example, order size of the object. And in that case, you don't interact very much. So when the dark matter comes in, has a very long mean free path, maybe it scatters near the surface, but it scatters also, you know, further away from where it last scattered. And in that case, you get a non-local thermalization, just because really you're sampling the temperature, kind of averaging over the whole of the object. So what I want to focus on first is this strong interaction regime. So you have a fairly short mean free path. You're going to see there are some interesting effects. Also, the calculation in this case actually is less straightforward than this weak interaction regime case. So what do we need for the dark matter distribution? There are two main effects that are going to affect how dark matter sits inside the object. The first one is very trivial, and we all know it, gravity. I don't think I even have to define this equation, I guess, except m chi is the dark matter mass. So really nice and easy, the dark matter particles sink quite easily towards the core if they're heavier. That's effectively trivial to model. The part that's harder is the standard model temperature gradient. So we want to think about how much the fact that the star or the planet has an internal temperature gradient will change the distribution. And this calculation is just something generally called thermal diffusion. So if you want to think about the fact we have dark matter particles inside a star or a planet, you have a large number of standard model particles that are already there. So the sort of regime we're in is one where dark matter is fairly dilute compared to the standard model particles. And there actually were a few groups that had used these sort of calculations before we had been thinking about this. But there were some discrepancies in the literature in terms of just understanding how this really worked. So we tried to go back to first principles and just derive this thing, you know, using kinetic gas theory. And thankfully for us, there actually was an excellent kind of applicable calculation in Landau and Lifshitz, which is the most amazing textbook series of all time. But they considered a dilute gas in effectively a fixed background gas. And that is very applicable to the case we want to think about here. So we modified this calculation a little bit to understand how it would work. And the general idea is if you assume you have some temperature gradient and you want to perturb the dark matter distribution along the gradient. So you imagine in the core, usually it's quite hot. Out near the surface, it's cooler. So you have some temperature gradient that drops off with radius. And you imagine if you're the dark matter and you're thermalized effectively locally, you want to perturb it because you can think about while the dark matter might be in equilibrium, it's still got its thermal motion and can bump around a little bit. So it can bump, you know, a little bit up the temperature gradient and sample the higher temperatures, or it can bump a little bit further down. So there's always, you know, the full Maxwell distribution plus a perturbation. So our distribution F is the sum of just a Maxwell distribution, F naught, which is a function of the velocity and the radius, which is the position, plus this perturbation. Now we want to try and solve this to figure out what the dark matter distribution is. So we can do this a couple of different ways. So we want to think about in terms of relating it to some interaction cross-section. So we think about a collision operator. Now, the things that will matter, we're thinking about how frequently the collisions are happening, is we care obviously about how many standard model particles are available to us. So that's this NSM. And we also care about the velocity. This is its V. We care about some interaction, this sigma T, so like a transport cross-section. And just with the way we parameterize the problem, there's going to be some function that we're calling G, that will help us get to what the collision actually is. So we're going to want to solve what this function is g. We don't know quite what it is yet. In terms of thinking about the collision operator or the collisions, we can also just take the total time derivative of the distribution. So that's this df dt. And because we're saying we only have this velocity and radial dependence, the time derivative really is just dr dt, which is v. And you can see this is the f dr, which gives you df dt. So this cos theta is also just how the problem is parameterized, but you can think about v cos theta as the velocity effectively. Now, these two different ways of thinking about the collision operator should be equivalent. So we can set them equal to each other. And then we can try and solve for what this function is that's moving us across with this little perturbation. And if we're in equilibrium, we want the flux that's moving through each cell to be equal. So you can have particles moving to the left, you have particles moving to the right, but it should be net. There's no particle flow between an arbitrary shell that you choose. So the flux moving through each cell, if that equals to zero, we can then just find the flux, set it to zero, and this should be our equilibrium solution. So there's a bunch of extra algebra and math. I won't go through the details because it's not particularly enlightening. But once you just crunch through effectively setting that flux to zero, you get something that looks like this. So n chi is the dark matter radial distribution. And we can just try and solve this expression for n chi. And you get something that looks like this. I'll tell you in a second why you should even care that I'm showing these equations. But the n chi LTE, so this is local thermal equilibrium, the radial distribution, this n naught is just some normalization factor. The T of R is the temperature gradient. So it's the temperature as a function of the radius. The T naught is the core temperature, just some normalization factor. And then we have this kind of interesting power here. So the only thing that's not defined so far is this mu. So mu is the ratio of the dark matter mass to the standard model mass. So that's just the target particles inside the star or the planet. And this actually gives you some interesting physical intuition about how the dark matter distribution will go under a temperature gradient, which is what you'll notice is that the way that the dark matter radial distribution scales with temperature is different if the dark matter is light or heavy. And interestingly, the dark matter distribution is not always the same as the background, even though it's in equilibrium, which was at first surprising to us. But you can try and understand this from some limiting cases. So if you think about the thermal velocity of the particles, it goes like the temperature divided by their mass. So if you're light, your thermal motion is kind of faster. If you're heavy, your thermal motion is a little bit slower. And what this actually means is that light gas spends more time in regions where the temperature is high compared to the background. So it's not that overall the lighter particles want to go where the temperature is high. They still prefer to move away from high temperature regions, which is what you would intuitively expect. But compared to the background, it's actually higher. And you can think about, you know, these very light particles moving around, bouncing off all the standard model particles. They actually effectively get a little bit more trapped in the high temperature regions, which physically is a kind of an interesting effect. So that's the temperature gradient. I told you gravity was fairly trivial. Now we can put these two together just to get what the full dark matter radial distribution would be. So I'm showing you the same calculation just to really hammer home how this works. Same thing, we just start with some Maxwell distribution. We're gonna perturb it along the temperature gradient. Collision operator, we write down just the same, except for when we take the total derivative, this time because we have also some force present, being gravity, before it was temperature gradient by itself. When we take the total derivative, we have an extra term. So you see that we have this acceleration. So that's like the d squared dr dt squared. And you would just have to differentiate respect to a different, also the acceleration as well. And then we really just push through the calculation the same as before. So we try and solve for this function g, that will give us some flux. We want to set the flux to zero through every shell, push through the math, you get some expression. And then just solving for n chi, you get here, this is the expression that gives you the full distribution for dark matter inside a star or a planet. And you can explicitly actually see the different terms that are important. So this first term is called concentration diffusion. This middle term is coming from thermal diffusion. And this kappa factor here would be zero if you didn't have any thermal diffusion. The kappa factor depends on the dark matter masses and will actually take into account the fact that the dark matter particles don't scale like the background gas at all, if they're lighter. And then, of course, we also just have gravity, so m chi g. And we find that actually we reproduce from first principles a result from, you know, more than 30 years ago by now, by Gould and Revelt, which was very reassuring. But this means we have an expression for how dark matter looks in equilibrium inside different objects. But the next question we wanted to answer is, what is the present time dark matter distribution? So it's one thing to say this is what it is in equilibrium, but an equilibrium framework assumes that dark matter was injected sometime in the distant past and had enough time to settle into its equilibrium distribution. If we care about signatures we want to detect now, we want the present time distribution instead. So how do we include incoming dark matter particles to this picture? So first of all, of course, the thing you want to think about is how much dark matter is actually flowing into the objects. What are your initial conditions? And the flux into the object goes like the dark matter halo velocity. And there's this factor in the middle here, which is gravitational focusing. So the escape velocity of the object over the dark matter halo velocity. You can see if the escape velocity is higher, you're going to get a larger boost from just this focusing effect where you can pull in more dark matter particles. And then, of course, we care about the dark matter density. So this is the dark matter mass density, particular dark matter mass, m chi. And f cap is just some efficiency factor for how easily dark matter is captured. So this depends on the cross-section, for example. So parametry, that's how, in terms of parametrizing it, that's how that goes. And then we can say from flux conservation, once the dark matter is, you know, flowing into the object with this rate, how much do we expect moving through each shell? And to figure out what to do next, we want to use the fact that dark matter actually diffuses pretty quickly through the object. So it pretty quickly goes into its equilibrium distribution. And what that means is that roughly, although not perfectly, each shell ends up having the same flux moving through it. So it's kind of like a quasi-equilibrium, really. And that means then moving through an arbitrary shell, we're going to call just this little r, and then the capital R is the radius of the object. The amount of flux moving through should be then just the dark matter number density times this diffusion velocity and the ratio of this little shell to the whole object. Now, so this diffusion velocity, we get this just from our previous derivation. We were deriving actually how much dark matter is moving through a shell at a given time, but this time we don't set it to zero because we want to just get how much dark matter flows through a shell. So this V diff before was zero, we now just keep it in. This is the expression that you saw earlier, plus some diffusion coefficient. And if we put that in, plug that into where we had our phi before, we end up getting effectively the same distribution that you can see that we showed before. So concentration, diffusion, thermal diffusion, and gravity, plus an additional source term. So this wasn't here before. So this phi is the incoming amount of dark matter you get from capture. So this actually is gives you fully the present time dark matter distribution inside the objects. Because it's a first order differential equation, we need more information if we actually want to solve it. But that part's fairly trivial. So we can solve together with just enforcing the total number of dark matter particles captured over its lifetime. So we know how much really is flowing in, and that will just allow us to a boundary condition for the problem. And that gives us fully the dark matter distribution. And what we actually find is that when we look at the radial distributions now, a lot of dark matter can sit at the surface of objects. So we call this floating dark matter. And I'll show you why in a second. I'll show you some plots for what the results actually look like. But just before I show you those, I want to briefly mention some other distribution considerations. So first of all, when I show you the results, we have to include something called evaporation of dark matter. And this is just the effect that when you have dark matter particles traveling inside the object, they get some thermal kick. And if this kick is very big compared to the gravitational pull on the object, it can just leave. So the lighter the dark matter particle is, the more it's going to care about these kicks because gravity is pulling it a bit less. And this will then set the lower mass threshold sort of cutoff where we have any sensitivity. Though this does depend on the particle physics model. So in this paper earlier, we actually discussed how this will change with your particle physics model. But just for simplicity in the plots I'm about to show, I'll focus on the contact interaction case, the most straightforward cases. I'm also going to consider non-annihilating dark matter when I show you the plots, just because if you annihilate too much, you can deplete some of these densities. Though it does turn out, actually, if you don't have very large annihilation rates, so you have something called like a P-wave annihilation rate, you keep effectively the same distribution. So you can think about these as being non-annihilating dark matter candidates, or just some that don't have really large annihilation rates. And note, again, diffusion is fast. So particles quickly go into equilibrium. So this means that we expect the bulk of the dark matter particles should be in the equilibrium position. It should be just some extra amount near the surface building up. So here are how some of the results look. So I'll show you for a few different objects. So first of all, this is Jupiter. Note this is a pretty big cross-section. You don't actually need the cross-section to be this big. This is just an arbitrary benchmark that we're showing. So on the y-axis, we have the dark matter number distribution. On the x-axis, this is the radial position. So R is the surface of Jupiter, zero is the core. We show these lines here for a few different dark matter masses. So for example, this 400 MeV, if you see the solid line, that is our calculation with the full distribution, including the non-equilibrium component. The dashed line is the equilibrium only scenario. So you see that particularly as the dark matter mass is becoming heavier, there's a pretty big discrepancy in what you expect near the surface for different dark matter masses. So notice, for example, the 400 MeV case compared to the 5GeV case, there is a much bigger difference that you'll see. And this is simply because the 5GeV particles more easily really want to, go towards the core. Regardless, actually notice that the y-axis is pretty big here. So what this means in terms of surface densities really is this is much larger than what you get from just the regular sort of halo values. So the typical halo value is like 0.4 GeV per centimeter cubed sitting, flowing into the surface of objects. But that which is already thermalized and sitting inside can be many orders of magnitude larger. So this is showing you here as a function of cross-section and the dark matter mass. Contours where if you sit inside the contour, the dark matter density in per centimeter cubed is larger than the value that's shown. Particularly once you start going to pretty big cross sections, you can be like 13 orders of magnitude higher than the halo value. Another interesting case to think about is for the Earth, how this looks. So we see again, if dark matter is lighter, it kind of sits more in this sort of flat, closer to flat-ish sort of distribution. And the amount near the surface can be really huge. So we're looking at, 10 to the 14, 10 to the 15 particles per centimeter cubed. So that's something you think you could maybe test. And again, as you go down to lower masses, you see that the difference between this, including non-equilibrium component and the equilibrium component really becomes larger and larger. So these are how the distributions look. Again, as a function of cross-section, can be very large. Compared to the local halo value. I should also note there's a few other papers too that have thought about these sort of distributions. So there's some example papers here. But what we're talking about here is the first full calculation that has all the effects in self-consistently.
Rebecca, and can you please remind me how much mass in total do you typically accumulate?
Yeah, good question. So it depends on the object, but it's really negligible compared to the total mass of the object that you have. So for example, here if you're thinking about, you're usually something like 10 orders of magnitude lower than the total mass of the object, but it totally varies on what the object is because the capture rate's different for the different objects, but multiple orders of magnitude below the mass of the full object in standard model particles.
What about the angular momentum?
Sorry?
What about the angular momentum?
What about it?
Well, these guys lose angular momentum when they accrete into the object, right? So is the angular momentum also a negligible amount? The angular momentum of celestial bodies, typical celestial bodies?
That's a good question. I would expect it is negligible, particularly because just the amount of mass that's inside them is negligible. If you're thinking about how much they're going to change, for example, the angular momentum of the system itself, I think it's probably what you're getting at, right? Is there some observable, if you looked at the Earth, would it change with its rotation or something like this? That's what you're thinking.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I will naively assume that it's negligible, but I'm not entirely sure because there's gravitational focusing. So these guys are coming from pretty far, probably from the right. So maybe
yeah.
Just an isotropic, basically, right?
Maybe it sometimes it cancels like back and forth, but maybe not. Because there's a wind with a professional.
Yeah, it's not perfectly isotropic. Usually that's roughly assumed because, you know, we still are moving when you think about, you know, we're moving through like the dark matter wind, but this is a really tiny effect.
Yeah.
I think at some point, like I also have tried to calculate this. I thought that would be a really cool signature, but you could think about the fact you have some directionality and then you can change, you know, some precision measurement, for example. But there is no existing precision measurement that would see something like that, just because I think the number of particles you have is so low compared to what's in the full object.
How should one understand the very sharp cutoff as you go down to low mass? Because it seems you go from like 13 orders of magnitude enhancement to nothing over a very short range of masses. What's setting that? If you look at the
next plot. Yeah. So is your question like what's happening here?
Yeah, essentially, yes.
Yeah, great question. Sorry, I mentioned this only briefly, but I didn't point out what it was on the plot. So thanks for asking that. This line here is coming from evaporation. So this is just when the dark matter is becoming like so light that it's not trapped inside the object anymore, at least for contact interactions. This changes in other particle physics models, but this case here is just a contact interaction. If you didn't have that, that's exactly what this line is. That's just like the evaporation line. If you didn't have that, you would see these contours actually stay pretty much flat. So this darker region would just keep going down as one bigger dark region. So you'd see 10 to 13 here as well.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, thanks for the question. Okay. All right. So now I want to, for the rest of the talk, tell you a bit about some of the implications, which I think is the fun part of this. So there's no signatures that we can have and we can actually detect. So just broadly, how these distributions can affect the signatures we already know about is that you can think about detecting dark matter annihilation products really for generic models. So I mentioned really briefly at the beginning of the talk that you could have, for example, this case where you annihilate really short-lived on a very boosted mediators and then, you know, the particles are absorbed inside the object, or you can have this boosted longer-lived mediator scenario. But in this case, if you already have a lot of dark matter particles sitting at the surface, in principle, you can have very prompt annihilation and then just detect those annihilation products because we're taking into account the fact that there are particles near the surface. So this can move the boundary between what type of search strategy you would use. But the first implication I want to actually discuss is what does this do for direct detection? Because, you know, if you're thinking about the fact that you have potentially a really large dark matter population at the surface of the Earth, you would hope you could see this, you know, do something with it. So this is based on work I did with Anirban Das, Noah Kurinsky, they're both at Slack. Recently, this was just accepted in PRL. And we wanted to think about, how could we actually detect this on the Earth? So the first thing to keep in mind with this population is that it's very slow moving. So it's thermalized within the Earth, which means that its thermal velocity is actually very low. So
can I interrupt briefly?
Sure.
Sorry. So did you talk about how this dark matter arises? Why is it there? Where does it come from? Why does it get the right? Is it the right abundance? Is it abdominal component of dark matter? What about the cosmologies of these guys?
Great question. So I didn't discuss any of the particle physics models, at least not at this stage. So the assumption so far is just that dark matter is some particle that's captured from the galactic halo. There's no particle physics assumptions.
Yeah.
Hello?
Captured scale, the density, for example, you have that's incoming accordingly.
So do you have any idea what type of model would produce this?
Yes. So you can have, for example, particularly if you want to sit, it depends on what mass range you sit in and what cross section you sit.
Well, let's say for some of the most optimistic stuff that you mentioned.
Sorry?
Let's say, so some of the most optimistic stuff that you mentioned, what do you get?
Optimistic stuff? Which
like
case
your
do you
optimistic
mean?
values? I mean, I don't know, how high of a cross-section? 10 minus 29, is that a possibility?
Oh, right, sure. Yeah, so for example, if you want to sit like up here, like what are you?
Yeah, let's say at 10 minus 29
yeah.
and mass of the jet.
Yeah, so usually, yeah, when you start thinking about models, but once you've exceeded like this 10 to the minus 30-ish, usually some very strongly interacting bound state is usually what people are thinking about. I think if you're thinking about the cosmological bounds, you're going to start running into problems when you start hitting 10 minus 27, 20 minus 8-ish around here. And in those cases, I mean, I'll actually show some plots. Maybe it's better to discuss it then in the cross-section mass parameter space where we have some sensitivity.
Yeah, but what is the microphysical model that produces this type of field of dark matter?
So one example is some bound state you can have. If you have strongly interacting particles like these like SIMPs or co-SIMPs, they naturally also sit pretty high up in this parameter space. So these are like these like 3 to 2 processors.
Oh, okay.
If you want to be a regular like 2 to 2 WIMP, it's pretty, this is not the standard parameter space where you sit. I'm not saying you can't be that, but I would not think that is the most likely particle physics model
okay.
if you're that high up.
Okay.
So usually, yeah, naturally GV sub GV-ish is like 3 to 2 freeze-out processes, for example.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thanks for the question. I'll talk a bit more about this as well.
Okay,
sure.
Good.
Yeah, not in detail, but a little bit more anyway. Good. Okay, so how do we detect this on the Earth? They're thermalized, they have quite low velocities. And if you're thinking about instead just the halo dark matter that's incoming, that has quite high velocities in comparison. So the halo peaks are in like 270 kilometers per second. If we want to detect something that has instead this much lower velocity, we need thresholds that are really low. So we're looking at something like 0.05 eV. This is definitely way below anything direct detection can do. So regular direct detection isn't going to help us here. You would just never actually see this population. So we need instead some new detectors, and we need things with very low thresholds below what direct detection can currently do. And we found actually there's this class of devices that are excellent for something like this. We call them just low quasi-particle density devices. Why we want to use these will become clear in the next slide for dark matter. But let me first just motivate a little bit what these kind of are, why people are thinking about them. And these low quasi-particle density devices have, at the moment, very important roles in existing and emerging technologies. So, for example, if you have some radiation detector, you want a low as possible sort of background. You don't want quasi-particles showing up in your detector. In terms of thinking about things like quantum computing, you also don't want just noise. You're going to ruin the whole fundamental process of how these systems actually work. So people have been researching in general, what are the ways that you can get lowest possible background devices? And the performance overall of these devices would be limited by quasi-particle excitations caused by things like broken Cooper pairs. If you break Cooper pair, you just get these quasi-particle excitations. You don't want that. So the study of a lot of these devices for these sort of applications outside dark matter is well and truly underway. And here is one device that exists that has a really low background. And the way that it works, this is just an example case to give you a sense of the detector, is you have some superconducting island. It's superconducting, so you have Cooper pairs. I guess that's kind of what's being shown here. And if you have something like cosmic rays, for example, or dark matter coming in and interacting, you can break the Cooper pairs, you get charges being released onto the island, and the quasi-particles then can tunnel through, and you'll just get charge flips on the island. So what you want is like the longest possible period of these Cooper pairs not being broken. So these devices, in terms of their readout, are just looking for charge flips where you just say, okay, something was broken, effectively, as they tunnel through. And because these have such low thresholds, this is perfect what we want to think about. I mean, the threshold is just set by the Cooper pair binding energy. So this is like milli EV, pretty low. And that's what we want to think about for, you know, the sort of setup we have for dark matter inside the Earth. It's very slow moving. It can just bump around very frequently because it has a really high density with these objects and should just keep breaking the Cooper pairs compared to having, you know, one very high energy but less frequent interaction for our standard direct detection scenarios. And this will give us a probe of the thermalized population, but it will also give us a probe of very light dark matter from the halo. And that's just because, you know, this is a low threshold device. If dark matter is very light, but it has a high velocity, you should also actually be able to see that. Okay, let me just go straight to the plot. Okay, so this is what our sensitivities look like. So these are the first limits using these single quasi-particle devices and also actually power measurements with super CDMS. They, in principle, could have seen this before, but didn't look, weren't using power measurements before. So you see we're really in, you know, for the, this is for the halo, this purple and this orange. The orange is this device I just spoke about. We're at pretty big cross-sections, unless you go sort of GV-ish, but the part that's really new is this lighter dark matter mass range. So there are definitely astrophysical and cosmological bounds. This is the first lab probe in this region. So it's, you know, somewhat more robust for that reason. This blue region you see here is the thermalized dark matter distribution. So that's the one I was telling you about that we derived earlier. So the halo, in terms of like just the incoming halo bounds, actually do a little bit better as we go to lighter masses. And you see this cutoff here, this is just this contact interaction evaporation process. Great. And so far, this is the strongest lab-based sort of bound, as I mentioned, in this parameter space. When you want to start thinking about the particle physics interpretations of this, once you go above about 10 minus 30, a lot of these bounds are not very well defined when you want to compare them with each other. And this is just from the fact that a lot of the experiments are still using the Born approximation, and that scaling really breaks down. So you ideally should be thinking about what particle physics scenario when you want to compare these directly to each other. So often up in this higher range, we have things like bound states, or as I was mentioning earlier, these 3-2 processes can work pretty nicely up on the lower mass regime. So this is the sensitivity we have at the moment. So we can just rule out this parameter space. This potentially will improve in the future. We have better devices, lower backgrounds that are measured, and maybe we think about some better materials, things like that. Okay, now for the final part of the talk, I'll just want to tell you very briefly about some implications for these distributions using Jupiter instead of the Earth. And this was worked together with postdoc Carlos Blanco, who's at Princeton and Stockholm. So if we want to think about any distribution we want to detect not on the Earth and elsewhere, we want to do some atmospheric measurement, probably. And it turns out actually Cassini is the best thing you can use for this. Cassini, you've heard about it, I guess. It's most well known for its measurements of Saturn, because that's what its mission really was. So it was launched in 1997, some time ago now. And it took 7 years to get to Saturn, and it was actually powered by plutonium, but it had quite a large boost from gravitational slingshots. So when it launched, it went around to Venus, I think like twice, Earth and Jupiter. And when it was passing through all these different planets, it's equipped with really a lot of multi-wavelength devices that can extract a lot of data from these systems. So that's exactly what it did. So during these flybys, it looked at the objects, got a lot of data on them, and now we actually have a lot of data, not just on Saturn, but on other planets like Jupiter, thanks to Cassini. And one of the actually interesting measurements that Cassini did on Jupiter was something called H3 plus intensity. Now, H3 plus is just like hydrogen cations, are something that are really abundant throughout the universe. They're everywhere. And the way you get them, if you're not used to thinking about them, is just from H2, so molecular hydrogen interactions with charged particles. So we have molecular hydrogen also everywhere in the universe, including Jupiter and other planets. And this molecular hydrogen can interact with a high energy charged particle. So this can come from things like cosmic rays, stellar radiation, lightning. And what happens then is you produce H2 plus. This H2 plus can then interact with the neutral hydrogen to give you H3 plus. So this H3 plus is really extensively studied in a lot of systems, particularly in planets. It's of interest because this H3 plus provides insights to the atmospheric temperature, just because of the way it de-excites, it inherits the temperature of the H2 nearby. And it also gives us traces of electric currents through atmospheres. So just from a planetary science point of view, people are very interested in this H3 plus, which is why, to start with, Cassini had actually measured this when it flew by. So we pointed out that dark matter is actually another source that could give you this H3+ ion sitting in the ionosphere. And we wanted to target Jupiter not just because we had the data from Cassini, but also Jupiter is quite big. So its capture rate of dark matter is quite high compared to other planets. It also has a relatively cool core, which means in terms of when the dark matter particles go in and get their thermal kick, they're getting less of a thermal kick. So it's a bit better at trapping dark matter particles that are lighter. And in Jupiter, the dominant species in the high altitude atmosphere is this H2. So we're going to have H2 sitting in Jupiter's atmosphere, and hopefully then dark matter can annihilate, produce these electrons, for example, energy electrons, that can then set off this process to give us H3+. And in general, what we're looking at is the infrared spectrum of H3+, so it's a full spectral measurement. And there are a lot of spectral lines that you see when you're looking in the infrared spectrum. And the strongest emission lines are around 3 to 5. So that's the sort of window that we want to look at. And we also want to think about how do we actually minimize our backgrounds. So the picture that we thought made the most sense is if you go near the poles, you have electrons that are accelerated by the magnetic fields, and you get auroras, like what we see on Earth. So this is actually not a good place. You get a lot of H3+ getting made here, just from these high-energy electrons coming in that are accelerated. If you're on the day side, you get a lot of extreme EUV. So coming just from the sun, there's a lot of ionizing radiation. You get a lot of H3+ there as well. But if we go to the night side, and we go to low latitudes, so really near the equator, there's effectively nothing. There's nothing that's supposed to make H3+ there. But dark matter, if it accumulates inside the object and it's kind of puffed out everywhere, it should be making this H3+ everywhere. So to optimize our signal over background, we want to look in this sort of region. And thankfully, when Cassini did its flyby, it has exactly this data, low latitude, night side of Jupiter. So that's what we want to use. So just by comparing the dark matter annihilation rates that you might have, and the measurements from Cassini, these are the sensitivities that we found. So y-axis is scattering cross-section, the x-axis is dark matter mass. So we can probe this whole shaded dark region using Cassini data. You can see the direct detection measurements. So this is the spin dependent, it's a little bit weaker, spin independent, a bit stronger. So we do see that we have some potentially pretty good sensitivity. Though the sensitivity here will really can change a lot with your particle physics model. So the assumption in showing this line is that all of the ionizing energy is deposited in the ionosphere. And this is not generically true at all for all models. So some you can saturate this line here if you had a case of, that I mentioned briefly earlier, if you take everything that's in the core and annihilates to something that's kind of boosted enough to get near the surface, you can get this. If you wanted to take purely contact interactions with very short range annihilation, you actually will be up a few orders of magnitude compared to this here. So, you know, you'd have to rescale this depending on what particle physics scenario you want to think about. We also showed here these dashed lines. So these are potential future sensitivities to exoplanets, actually. So this general process of H3+ production in planetary atmospheres is fairly generic. We don't expect it only on Jupiter. We just have the best data on Jupiter right now. But you, in principle, could see this using instruments like the James Webb Space Telescope. They actually have measured H3+ on some objects so far. So if we were lucky enough to see something a bit further into the galactic center, where the dark matter density is larger, these are the sensitivities you could potentially get. So I think the 1 kiloparsec is fairly reasonable. 100 parsec in the center of the galaxy is very, very optimistic. So the bottom line is probably much further in the future, if we could ever actually see that. But there are improved measurements expected in the future with different instruments, and also just better measurements of Jupiter, say with JUICE. There's this aerial telescope that's actually supposed to look for atmospheric chemistry of lots of exoplanets. So there's a whole range of things where we could potentially do spectral measurements of the atmosphere to see, hopefully, dark matter. Okay, sorry, to summarize, the dark matter distributions are important for signals in celestial bodies. In the talk today, I derived a general framework that included the diffusion, gravity, and non-equilibrium dark matter distribution. What we found was that you can have pretty large surface abundances, especially for light dark matter particles. And so this can be larger than about 14 orders of magnitude above the halo density, so it can be quite large. But this does depend, of course, on the cross-section size that you have and the dark matter mass as well as the object. But interestingly, this opens up new search strategies. So you can think about using these new low quasi-particle density devices for dark matter, and they can have potentially some improvement in the future as well. Or this H3+ atmospheric measurement. So we spoke about this in the case of Jupiter and Cassini, but improvement is likely in the future with new telescopes, new targets. So overall, there are lots of implications, plenty of new opportunities, not all of which I spoke about today. But overall, hopefully some new ways to find dark matter. So that's all I wanted to say. Thanks a lot for your attention.
Any questions?
Yeah, so I was trying to understand this, the H3+ thing, what sort of discovery potential you have. If you were to see some positive signal on the night side, can you guarantee that that's from dark matter or there's stellar backgrounds here? Like, what's the lifetime of H3 in the Jovian atmosphere? If you can like create it on the light on the sort of day side that rotates around to the night side, it's still going to be there type of thing?
Excellent question. So the recombination time is like order 10 to 15 minutes, so it's very fast. So while you could get some kind of going from the day to the night, not if you're really on the full backside of Jupiter. So as far as I understand it, there is no source that should give you H3+ at all on the night side. So I think if we did see a signal, it would be extremely promising. As usual, we would want to do some complementary measurements somewhere else to really be sure that's what it is. But as far as I understand, the background really is there should not be anything there. It would be very mysterious if something did show up there.
Even from like cosmic ray collisions with the atmosphere of Jupiter, you wouldn't somehow ionize enough stuff to be able to form this?
Yeah, great question. So you can form some, not very much. So that's something you could think about more for, say, like these other exoplanets that aren't within our solar system. The cosmic ray flux that you get at Jupiter that you wouldn't expect that's just going in through the poles, that like in where the magnetic fields are, is still effectively nothing on the backside or even around the equator. Okay. It's a tiny, tiny amount.
Oh, yeah, right. Sorry, I forget magnetic fields. Okay, yeah, fair enough.
Exactly, yeah, yeah. Yeah, because when you're in the solar system, you're really shielded from a lot of these things. We did actually check that for these other sort of exoplanet benchmarks. Would we have to worry about it then? But the backgrounds we considered for these lines were much larger than those you expect from cosmic rays. But in those cases, you have to think about them a lot more than if you're in our solar system.
Thanks.
Thanks for the questions.
Other questions? Other questions from Zoom? And so there is like, yeah, you can, Chris, you can unmute.
Yeah, can you hear me okay?
Yep.
Really nice talk. Thanks so much. There was a question earlier about where you were talking about the evaporation mass. Could you go back to that slide by any chance?
Sure. The one with the Earth?
Yeah.
Yeah, let's see. This one?
Yeah, exactly. Can you remind me why there's this above 10 to the minus 29, there's sort of this shelf to the left? Is that like trapping inside the crust or something?
Exactly. So the way this process works is that there's some optimal shell from which you evaporate that depends on your cross section. So that's why you see to start with, you know, there's kind of a bit of a shape here as well before you even get up to where the shelf region is. And if you have some sort of intermediate cross section, which is, I guess, maybe down here, it's roughly like the optimal shell from which you evaporate is like halfway through the object. And as the cross-section gets larger, this optimal shell becomes very thin and starts moving very close to the surface of the object. So it's dominated by scattering with different elements. And that's kind of what you start finding here. Effectively, it's just that it becomes harder and harder for the dark matter to get out. So it's coming closer to the surface, effectively. But the downscatter rate also is just getting very large. So it's a combination of a few different factors at once. But once you have a big cross-section, I mean, this also, if you start going to even higher cross-sections, it just really keeps going down to lower and lower masses. So this turnover here is mostly because the cross-section is getting so large, but it also has to do with the place inside the object where evaporation mostly is happening from.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, thanks for the question.
Okay, so there are no more questions. We can thank the speaker again.